So Om Gana Tumilanda Shag Nanjana Shilakaya Chakshurun Miditam Yena Tasmai Shigurave Namaha. So today is the commemoration of the disappearance day of Shripad Madhvacharya, so we'd like to speak about him today. So Shripad Madhvacharya is considered to be the third incarnation or expansion of Vayu, and it's called Vayu Putra, or it means the son of Vayu. And the other two are Hanuman, the famous, actually not quite a monkey, sometimes it's portrayed as a monkey. It's Kim Purusha, actually. It's like some simian features. Simian means like monkey features, and some human features, so it's like a cross between the two. So there's Hanuman, and then there's also Bhimsen, who both were expert in performing Herculean tasks. And then, of course, there's Madhvacharya. And so it's very important to understand the connection between the three of them, and I'll tell you one reason why, is that we know that Hanuman, he was worshipping Lord Ram. He was a great devotee of Lord Ram. And there's a whole story about Lord Ram receiving deities of himself and Sita that were passed down all the way from the sun god, because the sun god was originally given these deities. And they were passed down and given to Lord Ram. And Lord Ram decided not to worship his own deities, which was quite understandable. So he put the deities in the closet, and then in Ayodhya, there was a Brahmin who had vowed not to eat until he saw Lord Ram that day. And when Lord Ram understood that Brahmin had taken that vow and that it was causing him some disturbance, because Lord Ram would go on pilgrimage sometimes or go out to help the citizens, and the Brahmin had to fast. So Lord Ram gave that Brahmin those deities so that the deities could be worshipped and the Brahmin would see Lord Ram every day and be able to eat at least two or three times a day. So, and those deities were passed down, and eventually, of course, those deities were given to Hanuman, and later on, Hanuman gave those deities to Shripad Madhvacharya. And so those deities are still there in Udupi today. Udupi is one of the cities in Karnataka, which is a state in India. So Shripad Madhvacharya appeared in the year 1238. That's the Christian year, or A.D., and he was born in a family of brahmanas. It's called Shivali Brahmanas. But this family was descended from Parashuram. And we all know Parashuram is the warrior incarnation of the Supreme Personality of God. He's called Parashuram, which means Ram with the axe instead of Ram with the bow. So, therefore, because he was a descendant of Parashuram, he was actually also inclined towards, let's say, martial arts and fighting and all those things like that. And later on, we'll hear in his pastimes that he engaged his disciples, not only himself, but he engaged his disciples in different sporting activities. So his particular ashram, in one sense, was almost like a gym. because they would have competitions. You had to get to compete with your guru in wrestling. You get to compete with your guru in mountain climbing and swimming and everything like that. Interesting spiritual master. Anyway, so he was very much inclined towards the physical culture. I mean, culture of, building muscles and everything like that. And he stayed in this world for 79 years. Anyway, and he was also called Vasudev. That was another name of his, given by his parents, and Ananda Tirtha and Purna Pragya. Purna Pragya means that he's full of knowledge, understanding and knowledge. Many stories from his childhood are there about his great strength. One story is the tamarind seed story, that his father somehow or other owed a lot of money to a particular individual. And in those days, if someone owed you money, you would sit right at their doorstep until they paid you. And you would fast. And of course, that was considered like a big insult or very sinful if you had a guest and the guest didn't accept anything. You know, no water, no nothing. I mean, it was just like the guest said, no, I'm not going to accept anything. There's a lot of items in the Indian or Vedic culture that it's important for us to understand when hearing these particular stories. So anyway, so the guest or the person who was owed money was just sitting there on the doorstep, and Madhvacharya said, you know, what's the problem? And the guest said, your father owes me quite a bit of money. And Madhvacharya said, well, I'll pay you back. And he took some tamarind seeds and he gave it to this guest, and it's described in some of the biographies that Madhvacharya transformed these tamarind seeds into gold coins. And therefore, the guest was satisfied, you know, getting a whole bunch of gold coins. And also he was enamored, very much enamored, by Sripad Madhvacharya's innocence, bodily beauty, and purity. So another story from Madhvacharya's childhood is that once upon a time there was a demon who had taken the shape of a snake, and he was living nearby, and Madhvacharya decided to kill him. So what he did is he just took his toe and stepped on the snake, you know, big demon, just not an ordinary snake, and he killed this demon in such a fashion. Also, he was able to fly through the air. So whenever his mother wanted to see him, she would just say, you know, Vasudev, come here. And he would fly through the air and bloop, land right in front of his mother. So he did have the same ability that Hanuman had to do all those things. Mm. So he was very renounced from his childhood. And at 8 years of age, he wanted to take sannyas. And one of the reasons he wanted to take sannyas very early was that his guru's name was Achyuta Preksha. His guru was a little tricky, that whenever Madhvacharya would go to see his guru or his father's guru, the guru would give him sweets. And so it sort of got addicted to the guru. And he thought, you know, I want to be with my guru. Of course, I mean, obviously he's had some mundane pastime, just giving sweets and then addicting someone to sweets and whatever. So anyway, he was very attached to the guru, and he used to call the guru the sweet guru. And so he told his parents, you know, I just want to join my guru and take sannyas. And the parents said, no, you can't do that, because we do not have another son. In those days, and even today in India and many places, it's considered essential to have a son, because if you don't have a son, nobody's going to take care of you in old age. And as far as daughters are concerned, they're generally given away to the whatever family they marry into. So you can't really take it. Let's say if your daughter marries into a very rich family, you can't take advantage of that. You know, you don't get any money from that. But if your son marries into it, anyway, that's a different thing to take advantage, because the son stays with the parents. Anyway, so we even find in some cultures that people don't want to have daughters for that particular reason. They consider daughters to be a liability. But that's very insidious. That's actually not the right attitude. And sometimes they even have selective abortion in that regard. So, sex selection, that is. So, anyway, so he wanted to take a sannyas at 8, and the parents said, no, you can't do that because we don't have another son. Then Madhvacharya made a deal with his parents. He said, Dad, Mom, let's make a deal. And if you can have another son, then can I take sannyas? And they said, sure thing. But they were thinking they would never have another son because they were quite old at that particular juncture. And so what happened is when he was 12 years old, they did have another son, and immediately he left home and took sannyas from Achyuta Preksha. And later on, of course, his guru was a follower of Shankaracharya. Much later, after Madhvacharya had met Srila Vyasadeva, and we'll tell that story, his guru actually took initiation from Madhvacharya. In other words, the disciple became the guru, And the guru became the disciple. Hmm. So, but at that point, he joined Achyuta Preksha. And he started to teach, much to his guru's consternation, the philosophy of Dvaita. In fact, his philosophy was called Dvaita, Dvaita. It means dualism. Sometimes Madhvacharya is pictured like this, and that's the original victory symbol that the hippies later picked up on. Dualism. So, you know, extreme dualism. And actually, talking a little bit about his philosophy, his dualistic concept was, let us say, so extreme, if we contrast that with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's concept, that he even considered certain souls to be like irretrievably lost, you know, just like demoniac by nature. And irretrievably, you know, they're never going to become Krishna conscious. And then also, extreme dualism means that you don't draw so much of a connection between the Lord and the material energy. In other words, the Lord created the material energy, but it's not really having anything to do or controlling it or anything like that. Whereas in Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy of Achincha Veda Aveda Tattva, you have Krishna not only creating the material energy, it's not just like the prime mover as they discuss in Christianity. That's the prime mover philosophy. That means the person just creates and then, you know, whatever happens, happens. But he's actually giving the living entities intelligence, remembrance, forgetfulness in everyone's heart. He's directing the wanderings of the living entities. I mean, so many things he does interacting with the material energy, although he doesn't come in contact with the material energy. So, of course, the Achincha Veda Veda Tattva means one and different simultaneously, that the energy of the Lord is controlled by the Lord. And the way the Lord controls the energy is a person, and the person obeys the orders or the desires of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Anyway, so that's basically Dvaita philosophy. Mm. So, first, after he took sannyas and got a little trained up, at about 13 or 14, he started touring around various places in India. He was quite expert in different languages. So in India, there's all these different languages in different states, you know. And he spoke like 8 different languages, including Persian. And this would help him later on in his pastimes. We can tell that story. So anyway, he turned around, smashing what we call impersonal Vedanta philosophy, that philosophy that was taught by Shankaracharya, especially Shankaracharya's commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, which is known as the Sarvagrahya Bhashya. And so, anyway, he was smashing all these impersonalists, and then he decided he wanted to write a commentary on the Vedanta, because that's how a member of the Sampradaya would be considered bona fide, or a Sampradaya would be considered bona fide, if there was a commentary on the Vedanta. So therefore, he thought, before he could write a commentary on the Vedanta, he should go and see the original guru, or one of the original gurus in our Sampradaya, who is Śrīla Vyāsadeva. Because Madhvacharya and ourselves were members of the Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, which originally comes from Lord Brahma. Lord Brahma taught Narada Muni, and Narada Muni accepted Śrīla Vyāsadeva as the compiler of the Vedic literatures. Actually, the only author of the Vedic literatures is Krishna, or Lord Vishnu. And the other personalities compile it, comment on it. And so Vyas, actually the word Vyas means dividing, to divide, the Samas and Vyas. So he divided the Vedic literatures. You know, you have the 4 Vedas that were divided there, and then later on compiled the Itihasas, the Upanishads, the Puranas, the Pancharatras. You know, there's so many different Vedic literatures that Śrīla Vyāsadeva compiled. So he went to see Śrīla Vyāsadeva. Now, there's a problem seeing Vyāsadeva, because not only is he in Badrinath, but he's in an area of Badrinath that's not accessible, let's say, in the same dimension that we're in. It's not that you can just, like, take a plane you know, fly over. You can fly over the Himalayas. You know, planes go that high, at least the Himalayas that we can perceive. So it's not that you can do that or take a helicopter. Nowadays, of course, when they go to see Gomukh or Jamunotri, the people hire helicopters in India. Because I don't know if I'd be so bold to hire a helicopter in India. But anyway, they hire helicopters, and the helicopters drop them off. And previously, people used to trek. Trek means they used to go up the mountains like that. And but this area of Badrinath is in an area that's really is not accessible to those of us who are on the gross physical platform. At the same time, there's a Badrinath in Braj. Has anyone been to that Badrinath in Braj? No, none of you. Actually, it's in the western side of Braj, because it's described that all the holy places are there in Braj. You have Badrinath, Kedaranath. I went to Kedaranath in Braj. That's true. Kedaranath is the abode of Lord Shiva, of course, and then you climb, there's a mountain, Western Braj. No one's been there? Yeah, you've been there. You climb the mountain, and there's a cave, and it's Lord Shiva's there in the cave, in the top of the mountain. That's Kedaranath. Yeah, it's a deity of Lord Shiva, right in the top of a mountain. There's a mountain in Braj. I mean, it's a pretty high mountain. It's not like the Himalayas. But it's described that the holy places that you see elsewhere in India are all manifest in Braj, which is wonderful because then you don't have to go all over India. So since I discovered that, I don't take tours of other places in India. Previously, I used to take devotees to South India to see different places. I never went to the Himalayas. But we go to all these different places, and I said, look, everything's there. Rameshwaram is there. Ahovalam is there. Everything is there in Braj. What? Yeah, oh, Mayapur in Braj, yeah. Well, actually, Braj is Mathura Dham, and Mayapur is Adoria Dham. Mathura Dham means the sweet Dham. Adoria Dham means the very merciful Dham. And it's described by, this has nothing to do with Madhvacharya, but it's described by Bhaktivinoda Thakur in the Jiva Dharma that some devotees are concentrating exclusively on Adoria Dham, Mayapur, and some devotees on Mathura Dham, Braj, and some devotees are both. And devotees who concentrate on both get to be in both places when they go back to the spiritual world. Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains this. So anyway, but even in Adoria Dham, you find the places of Vrindavan. I mean, there's a Govardhan Hill that was constructed by Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur at the Chaitanya Math. And that Govardhan Hill is very easy to go around. You can do a Dandabhat Parikrama in about 3 minutes. Maybe a little more, 5 minutes, I think. It may take that long. So that's why Lord Chaitanya is very merciful. So if you want to do Govardhan Parikrama, you can do it like this. And in Braj, it takes a little longer, a few hours longer. Of course, if you're going to do Dandabhat Parikrama, it takes at least several days, at least a week to do Dandabhat Parikrama. So in any case, all the holy places are there in Braj. Never have to go traveling to South India, to the Himalayas. You know, I hear this all the time. The devotees say, well, I'm going to the Himalayas. And it's actually quite dangerous to go to the Himalayas. Devotees have actually lost their lives. You know, the buses fall off the roads there because there's no guardrails. I don't know if any of you have been in mountain places in India. But, you know, the windy roads, and they're just as narrow enough, maybe for one half of a car, and two cars have to pass, or two buses have to pass on these roads. It's quite intense. Except for Tirupati. Tirupati actually has one road going up and one road going down, Tirumala, which is actually the most advanced place in India. So, anyway, getting back to the point. So, Sripad Bhattacharya, he wanted to go to Badrinath to see Srila Vyasadeva, and he knew it was in the upper area. So he was traveling with his assistant, Satyatirtha. Satyatirtha was his primary assistant, also who wrote down different things like that. So Satyatirtha was accompanying him, and he was climbing the mountain. And then he basically sent Satyatirtha back by making him fly back through the air to the base camp. Base camp means like the camp that you actually, if you're going to climb a mountain, you stay there for the final ascent to the top of the mountain. That's a place for those of us who don't want to risk our lives. So he actually waved Satyatirtha down, and Satyatirtha just went, and he flew into the base camp. It's a very, very interesting story. So then he went to upper Badrinath, which is where Srila Vyasadeva is. In other words, if we climb the Himalayas, we will not see Srila Vyasadeva. And there he met Srila Vyasadeva, and he was able to write his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. And he was given a Shalagram Shila by Srila Vyasadeva to worship. And that Shalagram Shila was called Ashta Murti. That means the eight forms. I mean, number eight is very, very important in the Vedic tradition and in Vaishnavism. I mean, there's eight principal gopis. There's the Ashtakali Alila. There's so many things that are connected with eight. It's considered a very auspicious number. So he wrote the Bhagavad Gita commentary, and then also he started his commentary on the Vedanta Sutra at that particular time. Then he came down from the Himalayas to preach more about Krishna consciousness, to defeat the impersonalists. And he met two very erudite scholars, and he defeated them, and they became his two primary representatives. That's Padmanabha Tirtha and Narahari Tirtha. And he toured all over India. Eventually he came back to Udupi, and he was bathing in the ocean one day. And when he was bathing in the ocean, there was a ship that was going to be stuck or was stuck on a sandbar, and he sort of guided the ship so the ship could become free from the sandbar. And the captain was so happy with him that he gave him a big, big chunk of Gopi Chandan. And so he took this chunk of Gopi Chandan, and when he took it, it just split open, and there was a gigantic deity of Krishna inside. Now, some of the stories say that he found the deity while swimming in the ocean. But the story that I read was that he found it in the Gopi Chandra. And this deity weighed so much that 30 men could not lift him. So Madhvacharya himself lifted the deity. And that's how strong Madhvacharya was. And he installed that. That's Udupi Krishna. And you can see that deity of Krishna there. And you can also see Sita and Rama deities there if you go to Udupi today. Anybody here been to Udupi? Mm-hmm. What? You've been to Udupi. You seen the deities?
Yeah.
Beautiful deity of Krishna.
How big is it?
How big?
Oh, like this big, right? I mean...
They said 30 men. I haven't been there, so they said 30 men couldn't lift it.
It's not very good.
Somehow or other it was heavy. Krishna's the most heavy.
Krishna's heavy.
Krishna is heavy. I mean, it's just like when Krishna wants something, it's very heavy. Like the bow when they had the Swayamvara and Arjuna went to win Draupadi. Nobody could lift the bow except for Arjuna and Karna, of course. And Karna was actually denied the opportunity. So anyway, so then he began to tour India to preach again. And one time they were at a juncture between a Muslim territory and a Hindu territory, and the Hindus were afraid to cross. They couldn't find a boat. So Madhvacharya and his associates decided to swim across. And they got to the other side, and the Muslims were really angry with them. They arrested them and brought them to see the Sultan. And the Sultan said, you know, what are you doing? And Madhvacharya, an expert, erudite Persian, began to preach to the Sultan. And the Sultan was so much, impressed with Madhvacharya's theology that he agreed to give Madhvacharya a lot of land and some money. But Madhvacharya said, no, I'm not going to accept that. I'm the renouncer of life. So the Sultan let Madhvacharya continue on his voyage. Later on, as they were traveling around, there was this gigantic Bengal tiger. And the Bengal tigers are not just like little pussycats. I don't know if anyone's seen a Bengal tiger. You can see them in zoos sometimes. And they go into villages and they kill many people when they go into villages. So this Bengal tiger attacked Madhvacharya's assistant, Satyatirtha, who we mentioned before. And Satyatirtha cried for help, and Madhvacharya came, and he just separated them both. He didn't kill the tiger. The tiger just ran away with his tail between his legs, you know, being afraid of Madhvacharya. Can you imagine that? Actually, Prabhupada talked about how previously the Kshatriyas, they would kill tigers with their bare hands. And Prabhupada was visiting, and I forget where it was, probably Rajasthan, someone's house, and there was like trophies on the wall. Because like in America, sometimes you see like heads of animals, whatever, on the wall. And so there are trophies, and Prabhupada asked, you know, how did this animal get killed? And the Kshatriya, he related the story that he had personally wrestled with this animal and killed the animal with his bare hands. So, the, you know, there's really strong people in India like that. So Madhvacharya saved his disciple. Later on, there were some dacoits that attacked Madhvacharya and his disciples, and Madhvacharya just ran them off very, very easily. Then one strong wrestler challenged Madhvacharya. His name was Kadanjari, and he said, "Let's have a wrestling match." And Madhvacharya said, "Well, you're really not that strong. So I'll give you a special dispensation. I'm going to put my toe here. If you can move my toe, you've won." So this giant wrestler, you know, thug, whatever, went to Madhvacharya, and he was pulling his leg, like that, pulling. And he couldn't budge Madhvacharya's toe. And so he ran away at that particular point. By that time, the Shankarites, that is the followers of Shankaracharya, were really angry with Madhvacharya. And so they picked one of their prime exponents, whose name was Pundarik Puri, to challenge Madhvacharya to a debate. So Pundarik Puri came and he challenged, and he was so soundly defeated that he got angry and he arranged for one of his sannyas friends, whose name was Padma, essentially Padma Tirtha, to steal all of Madhvacharya's books. And so then they could argue with Madhvacharya without his books. But Madhvacharya was so expert, had a photographic memory. He didn't need his books. And he's still able to defeat these rascals. These books were later on recovered by a king named Jaya Singha. That means victorious lion. Interesting name. And Jaya Singha was so enamored with Madhvacharya, but still he wanted to see if his guru was actually more erudite or had a better understanding of the philosophy than Madhvacharya. So he arranged for his guru to have a debate with Madhvacharya, and this debate went on for 15 days. And Jayasingha's guru was defeated, and not only was the guru defeated, and the guru accepted Madhvacharya as his guru, but all the guru's associates, brothers, you know, and everyone else surrendered to Sripad Madhvacharya. Now, Madhvacharya himself left us with something that has been elaborated on by Bhaktivinoda Thakur and others, Baladeva Vibhushana, as what's called sometimes the Dashamula. So Madhvacharya is actually the originator of the Dashamula, which was later on elaborated on by Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya never really called it the Dashamula, but that Dashamula was adapted by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur and also Baladeva Vidyabhushana, who wrote commentaries on the Dashamula, adapting it to the Gaudiya philosophy. So anyway, so adapted to the Gaudiya philosophy, Baladeva Vidyabhushana wrote these different points. Krishna, who is known as Hari, is the Supreme Lord, the Absolute. Of course, the first point comes even before that, is the epistemological point. You know, how can you know the truth? You can know the truth. The Vedic literatures are the source of the truth. You know, first before talking about prameya, you have to talk about pramana. There's two different things. Pramana means evidence, you know, what you consider to be evidence, or talking about epistemology, how do you know what you know? Basically, you know, what is true, what is not true, and what is your source of knowledge. So that's the first point. And then after that, Krishna, who's known as Hari, is the Supreme Lord. Because with Madhavacharya, it would be Lord Vishnu. Krishna is known as Hari, as the Supreme Lord, the Absolute. And that Supreme Lord may be known through the Vedas. Three, the material world is real. That's interesting. Let me just comment on that for a second. Because basically, in the Bhagavad Gita, you have those things which are temporary are unreal. So what do we mean by that? First of all, the material world, the energy of the material world is not temporary, but it's changing in form. So it's one of those things that eternal, one of the eternal topics in the Bhagavad Gita. Sometimes the material world becomes unmanifest to our eyes, and that's called the pradana, when it's in an inert state. And that pradana is stirred into action by saikshita, the glance of the Supreme Personality of God at the time of the cosmic creation. He looks at the material energy and the material energy, and you know the time factor enters in, and of course then the Shambhu, Lord Shiva, who consorts with Maya and the material energy, starts to take shape. But the material world is real. But it's bhutva bhutva pralayate, as it's described in the Gita. Sometimes it's manifest, sometimes it's not manifest. Or as Prabhupada said, sometimes the whole show is only temporary. Or as Shakespeare said, life is a poor player that struts and frets his time on the stage and then is heard no more. In other words, it's not that the actor ceases to exist when the curtains go down. But the illusion is that you think the actor is the person whom he is portraying. Does everyone understand that point? That's the illusion. But it's not that the actor doesn't exist, or he ceases to exist at the end of the play. That would be pretty stupid. So the material world is real. And the next one is the jivas, or souls, are different from the Supreme Lord. Next one is, the jivas are by nature servants of the Supreme Lord. It's a little bit different than Bhaktivinoda Thakur's Dashamula, but it's pretty similar. Next one is, there are two categories of jivas, liberated and illusioned. And it's interesting, the Jiva Dharma, they actually go through five categories of jivas that are illusioned. Five categories of illusioned jivas. Some of them are just, I forget the exact nomenclature, but some of the first category is just so covered up like trees. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that one gets to be in such a body due to offenses against the Supreme Lord and the Supreme Lord's devotees. Then you got animals, and then you got human beings. And then he talks about, it's such interesting, about different varieties of human beings. Then you have the immoral atheist, you have the moral atheist, you have the, I think you have the theists, then you have the bhaktas, and then you have the bhava bhaktas after that, something like that. But it's very interesting how Bhaktivinoda Thakur breaks up the different categories of jivas into subcategories. I find that quite an interesting study. So anyway, the jivas are by nature servants. Two categories of jivas, liberated and illusioned. And of course, even within liberation, liberated jivas, there's actually different categories. There's Brahman, realized. There's those who are in Vaikuntha, and those in Goloka Vrindavan. And next one is, liberation means attaining the lotus feet of Krishna, that is, entering into the eternal relationship of service to the Supreme Lord. Then, next one is, pure devotional service is the cause of this relationship. So in other words, by the mercy of Prabhupada, we're executing pure devotional service, even though we're not pure devotees. And then finally, according to Baladeva Vijayabhushana, the truth may be known through direct perception, inference, and Vedic authority. That's actually Madhvacharya. And then Baladeva Vijayabhushana adds, these very principles were taught by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So, finally, which is a quote from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Prabhupada comments, for further information about Madhvacharya, one should read Madhva Vijaya by Narayana Acharya. I have a copy of that book on my computer. So, any questions about Madhvacharya? We just have another 1 minute. Yes. Different dates, you mean? Well, some of these dates are just approximate. Yeah, and especially when we're going back that far, you know, there's differences of opinion of the dates of the appearance of these personalities. So we don't. And another point is that when you're talking about Vedic history or the way the Vedas describe history, they're not so much interested in those particular details. They're more interested in Siddhanta. And Sripad Madhvacharya even commented on the Mahabharata. He said the Mahabharata has actually, he used the word corrupted. Not that it's a corrupt book in the same sense that we would think of the word corruption. But the Mahabharata has actually been changed, added to, things taken away. And so we don't take everything the Mahabharata says as the absolute truth. In the same way that we accept the Srimad Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita, because Mahabharata has not been passed down through the disciplic succession. Madhvacharya commented on the Mahabharata, but he actually said in his commentary, we don't accept it in the same way we do the Bhagavatam or the Gita or any of the other literatures. And also Bhaktivedanta Thakur in the Jiva Dharma talks about certain Vedic literatures have been, tampered with through the ages. And so they don't have the same level of authenticity. That's why we have to be careful. Sometimes devotees go through all these different Puranas and everything, and they start quoting from them. And you really can't accept it like that because there's different versions of the Puranas. We accept the books that have been passed down through disciplic succession. Okay, on that happy note, Sripad Madhvacharya Ki Jai. We're actually in his disciplic succession.